Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to Working History, a podcast on the New Books Network channel, New Books in the American South. Working History is a production of the Southern Labor Studies Association. Learn more and become a member online at www.southernlaborstudies.org. I'm series host Beth English, and today I'm speaking with Mary Stanton, author of books including From Selma to Sorrow, The Life and Death of Viola Liuzzo, and Freedom Walk, Mississippi or Bust. Today we're discussing her most recent book, Red, Black, White, The Alabama Communist Party, 1930 to 1950, published by the University of Georgia Press. Mary Stanton, welcome to Working History.
Thank you.
So your book is one of the first since Robin D.G. Kelly's groundbreaking Hammer and Hoe to focus on the Communist Party in the Great Depression South. And your analysis does a number of things that his doesn't. One thing, for instance, is that you extend into the post-war period. And if you could just start us off by telling us what brought you to write the book.
Sure, I'd be happy to. In 2010, I began with a biography of a woman by the name of Dr. Olive Matthews Stone, and she was dean of Huntington College in Montgomery, Alabama, and she got herself a grant from the TVA to study black sharecroppers in 1935 in Tallapoosa County, and I read the paper that she wrote and decided that that was a story I might want to tell. Mm-hmm. And she was an activist in her own right and a leader of a lot of very small progressive organization in Montgomery. There weren't very many white progressives in Montgomery in 1935. They included the local rabbi and some teachers and social workers. And during her research on sharecroppers, she met with a young man from New York City called Sid Benson. Mm-hmm. He was a member of the Communist Party who had been sent down to Birmingham in 1931, and he was trying to organize black sharecroppers. So they immediately had an affinity and had very many similar interests, and she invited him to come to a Norman Thomas study club meeting, and he did. And the club embraced him, the progressives down there, and they openly supported the Scottsboro Defense Committee and the work that the Young Communist Party, District 17, was doing up in Birmingham. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Stone actually introduced me to District 17 and to Sid Benson.
Okay.
And this collection of odd alliances, which we can get into, that really made up District 17. So I try to recast the material through Dr. Stone's eyes, telling us that her story, but the Reds demanded the whole stage, and it was never going to happen. It was never going to be Dr. Stone's story, perhaps rightly so. And so at that point, Dr. Stone's story ended. That was after 4 years of work on that biography, and the District 17 story began.
Mm-hmm, Mm-hmm. So to start us off with that background, that's a really interesting segue to into the work, you know, sort of finding, and in some ways that's what the historians do. They find a nugget and then they follow it and this amazing story comes out. Could you give us, for our listeners who might not be familiar with the Communist Party in the United States in this moment, could you give us a just a real quick primer to sort of orient us to the Communist Party and then related how it came to have its presence in the Great Depression South?
Sure. Well, you know, the Russian Revolution that overthrew the Tsar was in 1917. Mm-hmm. And Bolsheviks, of course, won. And in the United States, two parties were organized, the Communist Party and the Communist Labor Party. One was essentially more socialist and the other was more revolutionary. Mm-hmm. But in 1921, they merged and concentrated mostly on labor organizing in the North and the protection of political prisoners and immigrants. All of that work was basically done in the North of this country. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the party, International Party, became interested in the plight of Black people in South Africa under the system of apartheid, and they saw parallels with the South in the United States with segregation. Mm-hmm. Began to concentrate a bit on what could be done in the South. Mm-hmm. And things really came to a head, although there was some little presence in 1929 in Alabama. District 17 was actually organized in 1931, and I think is a direct response to the Scottsboro Boys incident. Mm-hmm.
Could you, again, just very quickly give a little bit of background to what that was about?
Sure. It was seven young men, Black men, riding in a freight car from Scottsboro, from Chattanooga. There was a fight broke out on the freight train between this group of Black young men and a group of white young men who wanted to take over that freight car. Mm-hmm. It was during the Depression. Everybody was going somewhere to try to find a job. The freight train was on its way to Memphis. That may, in fact, have been their destination. And the train was stopped in Paint Rock, Alabama, and the nine young men were taken out, as were a couple of the white men involved in the fight, and two young white women who had been also on the freight train. Now, they had been engaged in prostitution in Chattanooga, and they were terrified that if they were arrested, they would spend time in jail. Mm-hmm. So the sheriff who, you know, was interested in arresting these nine young men, said to the young women, "Were you attacked by these young men?" Well, the first woman, who was on probation, said yes, and she was the older, and she said, "Yes, indeed, we were." She was afraid of going back to jail, and the younger one, Ruby Bates, agreed with her. Mm-hmm. Make a very long story short, they insisted that they were raped by these young Black men. The oldest of the boys was 21 and the youngest was 14. Mm-hmm. And for the next 50 years, there were a series of Scottsboro trials. They were always, and retrials, and they were always found guilty. The young women were believed because in the South at that time, a white woman accusing a Black man of rape or even of accosting her, or even of insulting her, was always believed. And these two young women were not, you know, paragons of virtue, and they were believed anyway, and there was very, very little evidence that this ever happened. It did not happen. And it became a cause célèbre in the South, and the Communist Party took it as a cause célèbre to defend these young men. And District 17 was founded in Birmingham initially to support the cause. Mm-hmm.
Where was the Communist Party, and when we talk about District 17 specifically in Alabama, most active in terms of the work that it did beyond the work related to the Scottsboro case? What kinds of activities were being undertaken at the local level, and what were the connections that were being made between racial, economic, and social justice?
as I said, 1931, it was established in the city of Birmingham, which was called the Pittsburgh of the South. It was in a very industrial city, heavily funded by Northern industry. And in 1931, their assignment was to organize steel workers, miners, manufacturing and mill workers. But what happened was they ended up coming as the Great Depression was, the curtain was coming down on Alabama. And what they ended up doing, rather than recruiting workers, was that they began organizing the unemployed. And the assignment then was to organize the unemployed. But the Central Committee, going back to what the international, I told you that they were interested in the plight of blacks in South Africa and the American South. The Central Committee of the party had identified American blacks as, quote, a subjugated people, nation within a nation, as the blacks in South Africa were. And they believed that blacks, because they were subjugated people, were entitled to secede from the Union if that's what they chose. And the party wanted the young men and women of District 17 to work in the Black Belt, which was about 35 miles south of Birmingham. It was rich farm country, and most of the people there were sharecroppers, and the majority, the vast majority, were black. And so the goal of the party was to encourage these black sharecroppers to form a Negro Soviet Socialist Republic. Now, why did they choose the South? Because in the North, they couldn't test their theory of self-determination for these black people, because in the South was the only place where it was possible, because in the North, American blacks were pro-integration. And they were not interested in any way, shape, or form in self-determination or secession. But the irony was that neither were the black croppers. Some of these young men went in and shared the self-determination theory with them, and they were not a bit interested. I mean, for them, it sounded too much like segregation. And what they wanted, essentially, was a piece of the American dream. They wanted prosperity, if it ever returned, because remember, we were in the middle of the Depression at this time. And so the young Reds who were down there working with these farmers realized this almost immediately. They understood it was never going to happen. But headquarters in New York was slow to accept it. You know, it was a policy developed in basically in Russia with the international looking at South Africa and seeing parallels with the American South. But they weren't clear parallels, and it just was not going to happen. But the party kept on, the American party kept on trying to move it until about 1935, when they finally let it go. But this initial friction between the workers in the field and headquarters over the issue of getting the self-determination theory going in the Black Belt became a source of friction between the field and headquarters, and it wasn't always a productive relationship between the two of them.
Right. Could you talk a little bit more about something you referenced early on in our conversation about different groups interacting with one another, whether it be the political establishment, whether it be unions, at this community level? How is the Communist Party navigating its space in Alabama at this time?
Okay. Well, District 17 in Birmingham was responsible for Tennessee, Georgia, and the state of Alabama. So they were a very small group initially, and most of the people who agreed to go were from the North, had never been to the South. Get Alabama had never been to the South at all. So they get there and they're setting up the district. So many people were unemployed that in all the major cities they were responsible for, Atlanta, Memphis, and Birmingham, you had this flood of unemployed workers going to the city looking for jobs. Farmers who had gone broke were going into these major cities looking for jobs. and sharecroppers. So you had tons of unemployed, and these young workers organized them into the unemployed councils. And what they did was they led hunger marches, they protested foreclosures and evictions in each of these cities. They demanded relief from the municipal and state systems, and they turned the utilities back on as quickly as the utility workers, city workers, could shut them off. In fact, a lot of the miners in Birmingham who were laid off became real experts at turning these the electricity and water back on for the unemployed. Mm-hmm. And the atmosphere, and this was what fascinated me, the atmosphere of in District 17, I think you can compare it to a firehouse. Now, these were young men and women. The median age was about 24, initially white, but within 18 months, they had a larger black contingency than white because it was a depression, I would guess, an economic depression. You had more and more black unemployed workers and farmers drawn to this movement. Like I said, it worked like a firehouse. It ran on adrenaline. There were emergencies daily, and they overlapped, and there were crises and constant violence, if you can imagine that. Mm-hmm. It makes this such a dramatic story. People who had never been arrested before were working with people who'd been arrested pretty much on a routine basis in their lives, and they all ended up in jail for vagrancy. There was no money for bail. They stayed there months, 6 weeks. Some of the black reds ended up on work details. And they were working with an untrained staff. This had to be your calling if you were going to stay there. And headquarters was not always sympathetic. Headquarters was looking for results. And I don't think they really understood at the local level what these people were doing. Why they need the help that they requested.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
In many ways, your book is a collective biography of District 17. I've seen it described that way in a couple of different places. So I'm wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about some of the individuals and events that you highlight in your book that are illustrative of the larger work that was done by District 17, by this group of devoted folks that you just talked about. And not only the work they did, but sort of, you know, some of the challenges they faced, maybe some of the successes or particular failures they may have had. Just give us a sense of, you know, who these folks were and, you know, what kind of key events were a part of the story of your book.
You know, I'd like to stress the point that District 17 was not a white movement. Mm-hmm. It began with a lot of white Northerners, that you had men like Al Murphy, who led the Alabama Sharecroppers Union. Mm-hmm. He was a black man raised in Louisiana, who was sent to Russia by the party, who went up the ladder and became, as I said, a leader in the Alabama Sharecroppers Union. You had Mack Code, Angelo Herndon, who many people have heard of, and Hosea Hudson, who were all organizers, basically organizers of the unemployed. And then you had this incredible mixture of people. You know, I'll give you an example. There's not a whole lot of material on this period in depth, Dr. Kelly's book certainly, but my interest was to try to look at, as you say, the lives of the people who were involved. And the surprise was how many different places they came from and who they were. I'll give you an example. I was able to contact a man by the name of Jesse Auerbach, who's the son of James Allen, who was editor of the Southern Worker. Allen worked from Chattanooga, for District 17, publishing the weekly Southern Worker. It was a paper that went all over the South, and it was often read to congregations in black churches. Many of the people could not read. And it was a paper that really covered news that was not available in the press, even in the national press, but certainly in the regional presses in the South, greatly beloved. So Jesse Auerbach was the son of James Allen, and Allen's wife, Jesse's mother, Isabel Allen, who covered the Scottsboro trials from the point of view. In many cases, she wrote a lot of articles about the Scottsboro mothers who toured the country defending their sons and raising money for their defense. The Allens were Jews from Philadelphia who had never been South before, but they were second-generation Americans who were themselves working to achieve the American dream. Jim Allen was in graduate school when he joined the party. They were so disturbed by what was going on in the South and so receptive to what the party was doing that, you know, they became movers and shakers in the party. I also talked with people in Montgomery who knew or knew of Jane Speed and her mother, Darley Speed, and these were very different characters. They were homegrown Southern communists. And they were part of the rich Baldwin clan of that city, owned banks and railroads. I mean, there was a lot of money involved. And so completely different from the Allens. They were essentially white Episcopalians on the same mission. And yet the focus that District 17 kept as people came down, worked for the party through 17, and then went off and either went further south, went back up north, but got involved in the international labor defense, which was so critical, so absolutely critical to the work of District 17. The ILD was the legal arm of the party. They provided lawyers. They did all of the defense of the Scottsboro Boys through appeals and all the way up to the Supreme Court. And they opened an office in Chattanooga essentially the year after District 17 opened. If there were people who were basically responsible for most of the success of the party in Alabama, I would have to say it was the International Labor Defense, who really worked tirelessly in defending these young white black women. Men who got themselves in trouble or were arrested. Vagrancy was the issue. You know, you could always be arrested for vagrancy and sent to a chain gang or sent out of Alabama. And so these were things that these early pioneers really worked with. It's hard to describe the level of violence that it absolutely terrifying. More than a few were beaten, jailed, threatened, sent back north. They were certainly on a mission. And then finally, I spoke with Joseph Lilienfeld, who's a former New York Times editor, who turned out to be a friend of Montgomery's rabbi, Benjamin Goldstein, who was a member of Olive Stone's Norman Thomas Study Club. And here was a guy also from New York City, the rabbi. And he became involved with District 17 through meeting Sid Benson, one of the workers who Olive Stone brought to the club. And he became terribly involved in the Scottsboro defense cause and in the work of the organizers of the sharecroppers. And when I say that this group from Montgomery, all white progressive, supported them, they supported them with money. They opened up their bank books and they opened up their homes to shelter for the ILD lawyers who came down to work on the Scottsboro case. So you have the very poor, you have the fairly well off, you have white and black, you have social, you know, they used to say of Jane's speech, she put her nail polish on to go to the revolution, but she went and she did. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you have these people from so many different walks of life, educated and uneducated, and that they were able to focus, I think, that is what really interested me, that they could do it for so long. Mm-hmm. One can't do that forever, but there was a time and the time was right. And their work was basically to end racism, to give people an opportunity, a leg up. When they organized, you had asked me about the party's relationship with other unions. Mm-hmm. It was one of competition. Mm-hmm. Because the red unions were what they called revolutionary because they organized across racial lines. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was a competition. It often got nasty. Traditional unions organized by craft, mm-hmm. the American Federation of Labor. You know, they were interested in organizing white and skilled workers. The communists organized across racial lines. They stressed unity within these red unions. For example, you had the United Mine Workers, and the Communist Party then began their own National Mine Workers Party. And within the unions themselves, they stressed the unity of black and white, not only to get industrial equality, but social justice. Mm-hmm. And this, so it was, there was this sense of mission, even in the day-to-day activities of labor, trying to negotiate and get these benefits. Everything they did seemed to be a movement. Much of that came from the black church, and you carried over some of those traditions of, you know, everything comes from the same source, and we're in it, we're all in it together. And somehow that was able to gel with people of very different backgrounds, and it's really... that's really what interested me in this. And it's a fascinating story. I mean, it's got all elements of a good story.
It is really a dramatic story. So as the country shifted more out of the Depression and into World War II and then into the early years of the Cold War, what do we see happening in District 17? And what do we see happening with the organizers and with these very committed Reds, as you're calling them, in this part of the South?
Well, the story doesn't get a whole lot happier. But as we said, from 29 to 33, they basically organized the unemployed and sharecroppers. And in 1933, you had the National Industrial Recovery Act. It was passed, and it gave people the right to collective bargaining, protected organizing. And things began to look a little better. Mm-hmm. 1935, you had the Popular Front, which American communists began to cooperate with socialists and progressives, other left-leaning organizations, in a spirit of more collegiality, hopefully to get things done in a way that was less violent, that was more cooperative. And what happened was the communists stopped working with their own unions. Mm-hmm. And you had the CIO, coming out of the American Federation of Labor, and it was a more egalitarian movement and did recruit on an integrated basis. And you had a lot of men who had organized for, and it was mostly men who had organized for the communist unions, being hired by the CIO to organize for them. Now, this was very clever on the part of the CIO because the communist organizers had incredible experience. I mean, they knew how to stand up to difficult bosses. Many of them spoke a few languages. They knew how to run a meeting. They knew how to run an organization. And they knew how to bargain. Mm-hmm. And so the CIO really got a lot of benefit from the skills that were honed in the early Red Unions. But what happened was the CIO eventually began to tame their militancy. Once they got the benefit of the Reds creating sit-down strikes, and the sit-down strike was one of the most successful in the war, the labor wars. The sit-down strike was very, very successful because you didn't have to picket. If you picketed picketed the factory or the corporation you worked with, well, all they had to do was lock you out and fill the organization with strike breakers. But if you sat down and wouldn't get up, everything stopped. And a sit-down strike was very, very effective, as were wildcat strikes. Mm-hmm. But as the goal was to become more able to negotiate, more able to trade one benefit for the other, these things dropped out of the repertoire of the CIO. No more wildcat strikes, no more sit-down strikes. And they were also asked to soft-pedal attacks on racism. And this was probably one of the saddest things that happened. Many of the former communist organizers left, but it was the black population in the South who had worked with the Southern communists who felt that they'd really been betrayed. Mm-hmm. That, they thought that the fight against racism, the stand against racism, strong stand, had been bargained away by acceptance by the larger labor community. And that was very bitter. And you had the sharecroppers union that had been not terribly successful, but had made a stand in Alabama, being absorbed by a CIO union and essentially dying on the vine. So that you had all of this energy and faith and ability to withstand all kinds of abuse coming essentially by after the war, pretty much to naught. And during the war, you had a no-strike policy, no-strike pledge, and the beginning of labor management councils. And so the tide was really going out on radical labor movements. They weren't getting anywhere, and the wave was more collaborative, and many argued that rights were being bargained away. Well, the irony of this whole thing is that after the war was over, leftist organizers who were still in the CIO, and there were some but not many, but they were purged, and CIO actually waged war against them. And that was the end of that collaboration.
What do you see as the important takeaways from your book and your fresh look at the Communist Party for us to think about as we wrap up our conversation today?
All right, and thank you for the opportunity. I worked on this thing for 10 years, so I had a lot of time to think about it.
Sure.
And I have four takeaways that I think are relevant. American communism, I would say, at least the branch that I studied, I think should be understood as operating within the American radical tradition. Mm-hmm. It's not something foreign. What I lived with it, for heaven's sake, and I see it as American, as revolutionary, and as egalitarian. And that's all within the definition, I believe, of the American radical tradition. Number two, I believe that the Reds in Alabama, specifically, exposed something called systemic racism in the South. Now, we hear about it a lot today, but they really fingered it in the South and broadcast it, demonstrated against it, worked against it. And systemic racism is where institutions that are dedicated to preserving white supremacy at that time often acted as a unit more viciously, if one can believe it, than any one individual might. Mm-hmm. So you had the party confronting corporations, heads of corporations, confronting law enforcement, legislatures, and judicial systems. And they were not afraid to speak out in court, in the press. And, it was a very dangerous thing to do. And they took it on. And I do, in fact, admire that. And thirdly, I think they defined legal lynching. And for them, there were a lot of organizations in the United States that were against lynching, that tried to get a lynch bill, ran anti-lynching crusades. And if we go back to the Scottsboro Boys situation, Alabama was actually proud of the fact that the Scottsboro Boys weren't lynched, that they went through the legal process. They were saying, you know, the South is changing. These boys were not lynched, but they went through almost 50 years of subsequent torture through the legal system, mm-hmm. And many spent better than 20 years in jail. Well, legal lynching for the Reds was where jurors were willing to accept any evidence or none at all to justify sending blacks to their deaths. So you didn't need a tree and you didn't need a rope. Just folded your arms and you could justify in the courtroom the death penalty. Mm-hmm. And this was distinct from jury nullification. In jury nullification, jurors disregarded any and all evidence in cases of white on black crime and refused to convict. So that was sort of the inverse. And finally, I think that a takeaway should be a look at these young communists demonstrated the power of mass protest. With the help of the International Labor Defense, with the help of the American Party, they really raised hell. That was their defense. If you had a cause that was not working out, they always believed if they could get to the American people through demonstrations, through the press, that they might be able to get a decent hearing of the issue. And still, we look to the power of the press to help through the difficult times. Mm-hmm. And to change minds and change directions in American society. And I think these four are all really valuable accomplishments. They've spilled into the 21st century. They're the basis of some of the justice we're still trying to accomplish. It's an amazing story of where these people came from, how they put this party together, who was involved, and what they've given us.
All right. Well, Mary Stanton, thank you so much for sharing a little bit about your book. And hopefully folks will pick it up and give it a read, because it really is a very compelling story, as you've said. Thank you for joining us on this episode of Working History.
Appreciate it.
Thanks again to Mary Stanton for joining us to discuss her book, Red, Black, White. And thank you for listening to this episode of Working History, a podcast on the New Books Network produced by the Southern Labor Studies Association. Become a member of SLSA online at www.southernlaborstudies.org and follow Working History on Twitter at Working History.